I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program photographer Craig Varjabedian. His new book of photography is called Landscape Dreams, A New Mexico Portrait. And he will be tomorrow night from 6 to 7 at the CCA Cinematheque in a presentation with writer and poet Jeanetta Calhoun Mish and Doug Peterson. And the event is hosted by Garcia Street Books. Welcome, Craig, to the Radio Cafe.
Gosh, it's what a pleasure to be back here.
It's great to have you back. And every time you come back with yet another beautiful, magical book of black and white photographs.
Well, you're very sweet to say.
And this is one, I mean, it's one thing I really appreciate is that you do so many different kinds of photographs. You do portraits of people in New Mexico and places and landscapes and different kinds of day and architecture and new things and old things. Is there any common thread for you? I mean, is it the state itself?
I think it's almost the state of mind itself in a way. You know, I don't want to be limited by subject matter, because subject matter is, in the end, it's really just a conduit to take the viewer to a place that, you know, I discover through the lens of my camera, you know. And so when I look into old cowboy's face, or I look into a beautiful landscape, you know, in some ways they're resonating in a kind of similar way, much in the same way, you know, that if you take your finger and you run it around the edge of a wine glass and it starts to hum and sing, you know, it's like that, you know.
Really?
The two things. Yeah, I think that they are, because I think one begats, in some ways, feeds or begats the other, or influences the other, maybe, you know, that the land that we live in creates the people that we become, and at the same time we define or describe what the land is.
One thing that I've been getting interested in, because I've lived now in New Mexico for such a long time, and I think you have too, is that right?
25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that there's something that happens when you live in a place for a long time and you're an artist, is that you see it differently from the way a newcomer sees it. And it's not that the newcomer's way of seeing is bad or superficial, though sometimes it is, but there's something about the layers of the land that and of the people where you are avoiding cliches and going in deeper in some way. Do you know what I mean?
I absolutely do, and I think that your analogy of the layers, you know, thinking of it like almost like an onion, in a sense that you peel off very, very slowly those layers as you become clearer about what it is that there is here to photograph. I'm drawn to a power that New Mexico seems to have. I don't find it anywhere else. You know, I was in Montana for a week last week, as a matter of fact, and Montana is an incredibly beautiful place. And so my remark is in no way, shape, or form intended to, you know, slam Montana in some way. But it's different, you know, much like Michigan is where I was the week before, you know. It's just different. And what's going on here just seems to, for me at least, seems to almost defy reality, you know.
What do you mean?
Well, I think that I've seen things as a photographer over the years that I couldn't explain, you know. And you have to wonder in the large scheme of this thing about, I mean, aside from, you know, the aliens that supposedly landed in Roswell, you have to start to wonder about a place where, you know, you've got a guy down in, say, Clovis, New Mexico, you know, who redefines rock and roll music, and you've got a guy up on a hill just north of here who creates the atomic bomb, and what kind of a place spawns something like that, you know? And to me, that's absolutely magical. And magical, it's sort of one of those words that gets bannered around. People throw it around and say, ooh, this is magic, you know. But I think there's something deeper and more profound happening here in New Mexico than I've been able to experience in other places. And it's that thing that draws me to want to go out and photograph it.
There's a nice foreword by the terrific writer Hampton Sides, who has become a New Mexican by having lived here for so long.
Right.
And he writes about his skepticism when everybody talked about the light in New Mexico, and then saying, there's something to this, isn't there?
Yeah, in my case, there are times I see it where it almost seems like something you could reach up and grab. You know, the light takes on almost a physical form, you know. And to me, that's profound. You know, I don't see that in other places.
And there is something that I see in your pictures, or at least that I imagine happens in your pictures, is you probably spend a lot of time kind of scouting and then waiting.
A lot of waiting, a lot of scouting, yeah. A lot of times what happens, too, when you're out photographing, you'll come across a place, but it's not the right time. the light isn't right. You know, the elements aren't right. The time of year isn't right. The whatever those intangible elements are that we're talking about just aren't there at that particular moment. But you have some sense that, you know, they're lingering somewhere here. And you come back to it at a later time, and sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. And I found places, like when I was working on my Ghost Ranch book, that I had to go back to again and again and until finally the magic happened, you know. There's a great old expression, and I can't think of who said it at the moment, but who says sometimes the magic happens and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
And that's really part of my experience as a photographer. You go out and you're best, you're prepared, you're emotionally available, you're right on your game. But, you know, the date doesn't show up, so to speak. You know, you're there and you can't make the picture.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sort of sounds like friendships that happen and don't happen. Sometimes the most unlikely human contacts happen, and sometimes what should be a great match
just
goes
doesn't.
Flat.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So when you're out there and that magic happens, do you know it at the time? I mean, are you still work? You're not working with digital, are you, or are you?
I work a little bit digitally, because the great thing about digital is that sometimes it's the right tool for the right situation. You're photographing a horse in a corral, you know, and things are moving and happening fast, and the horse is maybe skittish or something like
yeah.
that. And so you need to make the picture, and the large camera just doesn't allow for that experience to happen. Or in some cases, you know, like particularly during this beautiful time of year, you know, you want to bring some color into your work, and digital photography provides me a really easy access to
right.
that, where I wouldn't necessarily be able to do that so easily through film, because of just the complicated part of getting it processed and getting it printed and all that sort of stuff, which is certainly possible, but I have a lot more control over it at my end through the digital process than I have any other way.
And so the black and white photographs in this book, are they mostly film or digital or some of both?
Probably 90 to 95% of that book was all shot on film. And there's probably 4 or 5% that were shot originally as digital captures.
So then you're still working with large format camera.
Correct.
Which is a big, old-fashioned thing in a way to lug around to wherever you're going.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
then you have to wonder whether you think that magic moment arrived and you captured it, but you won't know till you get home and process the film.
Well, that's not quite true. The fact is that when... For the most part, when I've released the shutter, I either know I have it or I don't. I mean, it's. I've been doing this for so long now. I recognized the other day that, you know, because some student up in Montana asked me, you know, how long have I been doing this? And I had to sit there and start counting my fingers and my toes. And it occurred to me that I think it's pretty close to 40 years now that I've been making pictures.
Wow.
And for the last probably 25, you know, it's really been with a view camera. And... I know that when I've released that shutter and before I'm done shooting, either I have it or I don't. And sometimes, like I said, you just don't get it. The picture just doesn't arrive for whatever the reasons are. But more often than not, if you just work hard enough, you know, and everything aligns properly, you know, the photographer's rewarded, you know, with a wonderful image. And one of the things I probably should throw into this conversation is just the notion of gratitude. You know, it's a huge part of what I believe, you know. I mean, I don't think we as a society say thank you nearly enough to each other. So let me just start by saying thank you to you for doing this today. This is really sweet. But also when an image chooses to make itself available to me as a photographer, I'm just so grateful that this little visitation, if you will, decided to appear in front of my lens, because they're so fleeting and they happen so fast. They're fractions of a second. You think about photography, you know.
Yeah.
It's always moments of a second that you're capturing. And the difference between, you know, second one and second four, you know, if you were shooting a series of pictures, can be vast.
Right.
And you either have it or you don't. And like I say, I know when I'm done, it's done.
We're talking to photographer Craig Varjabedian about his book, Landscape Dreams, A New Mexico Portrait. Now, some of the beautiful portraits are actually portraits of people and animals, and sometimes people and their animals. And I wonder what that process is like when you meet these people. Are they people that you've known for a while? Do you have to get to know them before you take the pictures?
I think I'm more effective in making portraits of people to photograph people I know. But I some of the people that I did photograph in the book, I really did not know. There's a photograph in there of Richard Stump, you know, who's a trainer and a, you know, an outfitter and a wonderful cowboy. And I just met him basically at a roping, and I asked him if he would come on over to this wonderful wall out at the Mortensen place down near Cerritos, and if I could photograph him. And he's standing there, kind of standing there, with a big cheesy grin on his face with his horse. And he says, "Do you want to see my horse do some tricks?" And I said, "I would love to see your horse do some tricks." And then he has his horse basically make that bow that you see in the in the book. And you're almost knocked off your guard, you know, to see this happen, because this is one of these things that almost defies my sense of reality, because I just had never seen a horse do that before. And I was like, "Oh, my God." You know, "Oh, my God." And so I said, "Richard, could you please ask Sparrow to do it just one more time?" And I got myself into the right position. I made one exposure, and I shot it digitally. You know, it's one of the very first digital photographs that I had ever made. And I'm absolutely delighted with the result.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been messing around with digital photography for a number of years, but never really making anything beyond sort of pictures of the, you know, the kid's birthday party or, you know, that kind of stuff. This is the first image that I really felt like I could put on the wall and say, this is an image that people needed to look at.
There's another one, and my bias will be revealed to regular listeners, of a Jack Russell Terrier in the saddle of a horse looking for all the world like he's about to ride away.
Isn't that funny?
It's so great.
It's and it is a wonderful image, but what I found, I knew the family for a long time that owned the horse and the dog, and it was just one of these wonderful confluences where we're out there, and I was actually out there to photograph a portrait of the woman who owned the horse and the dog, and she said, "You know, my dog and my horse really like each other," and I said, "Really?" And she just kind of snapped her fingers, and the dog leapt, and you know how Jack Russells like to
jump. They can jump very high.
I think it's miraculous. They're like kangaroos in some sense.
Yeah.
But the dog literally just jumps up into the saddle of this horse, and I was just dumbfounded to see this happen. You know. I mean, it had its own profundity, really.
Yeah.
And the horse seemed almost nonplussed by the whole thing. Not angry, not, you know, whatever. It just stood there. And the dog just seemed kind of regal and proud to be sitting in that saddle of this horse, you know.
Right.
And apparently the dog will ride with the owner of the horse, you know, kind of across her lap, you know, while she's out tending cattle or whatever it is that she's doing. The dog likes to go out and go do that.
They're work dogs.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are. And when you see them, you almost don't think they are, if you know what I mean. They don't look like big cattle dogs or whatever, you know.
Because they're small and cute.
That's right. That's exactly right. But they are amazing, amazing dogs. You're right.
And there's other pictures of people and animals. A couple of photographs of a farmer holding a baby goat.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, I took that down in Picacho, which is west of Roswell. And this is this old rancher down there who raises goats. And that little goat was born just a couple days before Easter, you know. And, in fact, the picture that you're seeing, the goat's only made 15 minutes old, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they're very, very young, but they get up very quickly, you know. It's really quite remarkable. And there was something, you know, I have a version of that you can actually see in the essay, Janetta's essay, where you actually see him, see the figure of the rancher holding the goat. But there was something about the man's hands and his relationship to the goat that almost the shape of his fingers, somehow the lines and the shapes of those things reminded me of the shapes within that goat and its muscles and so on. And so the picture really, I took several versions, obviously, and I decided the one where I regretfully lopped his head off, you know, was the one that really spoke about the relationship that I wanted to create there. And it was really almost a giveaway, or not a giveaway, but almost a pickup, you know. I just did it at the last minute and not even sure that I was going to like it or do anything with it. And when I got back, this is one of those few times where I didn't know I really had anything.
Right.
So I got back to Santa Fe and I was looking at the images on the computer and I looked at this thing and went, "Oh my God, look what I, you know, captured." And I mean, another gift.
There are also pictures of inanimate objects that seem animate. Like, there's one which I found weirdly moving of a fallen windmill.
Yeah.
And it was like the thing was dead. But it was never really alive to begin with, but it kind of was.
Well, you think about the thing spinning at the incredible rate it must have on a windy, you know, stormy day, you know. It must have been absolutely flying up there. And for it to have fallen over, it must have been quite a calamity out there in that landscape, you know. And so that's kind of what I saw. I mean, my friend Archie West, you know, who's actually his photographs on the back cover of the book, talks a lot about, you know, the old West is gone. You know, it doesn't really exist anymore. And it was, so I almost see that photograph as almost kind of as an elegy, you know, to that old West in a sense.
Right. Although I have to say, looking at your book, The Old West is not entirely gone.
Well, I agree with that, actually. I mean, I think it's still around. It, you know, that wonderful historian who lives here, Mark Simmons, often will say that one of the reasons why he came here in the first place from Texas was that our history is still above ground, you know, and that makes it much easier for the photographer to go ahead and include that in some way in his or her work, you know.
Well, and you photograph things that at some point will probably be archaeological ruins, and they kind of look like that now.
Yeah.
Like there's a ruin of a hotel. It's just the walls, not even all the walls that are remaining, but that they have arches that look like old Roman arches.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we have everything here in New Mexico, you know. And that's another thing I was going to actually comment to you about as well, is that I can't imagine in my lifetime running out of things to take pictures of here. Because there's always the next thing to explore, you know, and for me the photographic process is partially that it's the exploration and what do I get a chance to learn, you know, and the camera is a great conduit to get there, you know.
Yeah, and it's its own kind of poetry. I mean, we're going to be talking tomorrow to Miriam Sagan, who, in her newest book, has talked about making poetic maps of place. And this is like a photographic, in a way, a kind of, what would you say, non-linear photographic map of New Mexico.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And in fact, when you look at the book, you know, I was really unable to sort of cover the entire state geographically. In other words, there's not a photograph from almost every square mile of this place because, as you well know, it's
a lot of square miles.
New Mexico's huge.
Yeah.
And but what I hope happens when someone reads the book is, number one, they get a sense of, you know, my personal love of this place, but also, two, that the images in and of themselves speak much greater than, you know, from the locations that they're from. In other words, when you see a cowboy in this book, I'm hoping that it speaks about all cowboys. And when you see a fallen windmill, it doesn't just speak about Abiquiu, where that picture was made, but it speaks about our state, you know, and where else you could find fallen windmills, which are plentiful here.
How did the people you take portraits of respond to their portraits?
I've never had anybody hit me, so it's all pretty good. But the what I love is that one of the great things about shooting portraits of people, in my view, is that they will outlast not only the photographer who made them, but certainly the people who were actually photographed. You know, we made a portrait of you before we started our conversation today.
Yes, he sat down at the table and made a picture with me with my headphones.
I know, and it's a great, and I think it's a great picture. And what's wonderful about that image is that, as you know, when the day comes when we no longer have the privilege of, you know, listening to you anymore on this, which I know will be many, many, many years from now, you know, this portrait will live even further, you know, beyond you and beyond me, and will end up as a record of a small record of your time here.
Well, you know, that's an interesting concept, because I've been thinking about what lasts and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And there, we have so many digital images that we're drowning in digital images on some level.
Yeah.
On, you know, Facebook and all the emails that we send each other and all the different ways that we shuttle media around. And when I think about, like, if I had to, God forbid, my house were on fire and what I had to take out, it'd be my paper photo album.
Yeah.
You know, and I wonder if you think about what lasts and what doesn't and how you make sure that the things that you want to last do.
All the time, actually. It's a big deal. And part of this growth in digital photography has been this difficulty of how do we preserve it? You know, because clearly with the accessibility through the technology to making images today, you know, there's a lot more images being made. I mean, I took a photograph with my iPhone of you as we were sitting here, and a lot of people take pictures with iPhones. That's why there's a great camera inside that thing. And but what happens to that, this mountainous number of images that are being created, you
most
know?
Of which are no good.
I don't know.
I don't mean yours,
yeah.
But you know, everybody's got an iPhone, everyone's suddenly a photographer, and most of those pictures are not worth preserving over centuries.
Maybe or maybe not. You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, images are important simply as records. You know, you take a picture of, you know, you and your Aunt Martha or something, you know. And while it may not be something that'll ever hang in the Smithsonian Institute or the National Gallery or something like that, it's an image that still is important simply to perhaps your heirs, right. that, you know, Mary knew her Aunt Martha, right? And here's a record of us knowing that, you know?
But then when it comes to your work, how do you think about it?
You know, the notion of this really, I don't know if I should reveal this in such a public forum, but it really kind of terrifies me, simply because I worry about becoming irrelevant, you know, as an artist. I think many artists think about this, you know, because once our work is gone, you know, that becomes a tangible thing that shows that we were here, you know. I mean, there might be great stories that'll last for a little while, but even those will disappear in time,
yeah.
you know. So it's our work that continues to move on and move further into the future, you
right.
know. And so, so I've already started in my own way, you know, looking at ways to preserve this thing, and I've already begun conversations with several archives in the United States to claim my work and to take care of it in perpetuity.
Yeah.
Because I don't want that to happen. I mean, I took these pictures for a reason, you know, and I want them to have a life beyond my time here.
Which is so interesting. We're talking to Craig Varjabedian about his book, Landscape Dreams, A New Mexico Portrait, because there's a lot of work that speaks beyond its time. And this may be exactly that, as Ansel Adams' work speaks far after his time. And there's some work that is really of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's gone, it's gone. And
yeah.
it doesn't last, and it's not meant to last. And you can dredge up popular songs from the 1890s, and it's better to put them back.
Isn't that true?
That's
for
exactly
example.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, some of the cheesy songs from the 1960s, and the Beatles last and the other ones don't, and there's a reason for that.
That's right, exactly. And I think that's a quality of great art. And I think you can sit there and try and rationalize it in as many positive ways as you can, but ultimately, I think the reason that art lasts is something intangible. It's something that touches lots of people deeply, and sometimes are not even, or most people sometimes are not even aware of that thing that's touching them. You know, it took a long time for people, for example, to understand why, you know, the Mona Lisa was so beguiling. What was going on there, you know, that caused people just to be so mesmerized by her stare, you know? It's magical, really, again.
Now, the book, Landscape Dreams, A New Mexico Portrait, has several essays in it. Talk about the process of getting these folks to write and how you worked with them to make this whole book.
Well, the process is really collaborative, except that what I was not looking for was someone to sort of illustrate my pictures. And at the same time, I really wasn't looking, except in very precise ways, of the body of the book, the body of the pictures in the book, really illustrating the essays. In other words, the two are meant to sort of operate independent of each other, but at the same time, complement each other. So, for example, Marin Sardi's essay, you know, when I started working with Marin, and I had worked with Marin, actually, on my previous book, Ghost Ranch in the Faraway Nearby. And I asked Marin, basically, to cast a wide net visually across New Mexico and take a look at the things that sort of, you know, came back, you know, in the net. And she's from an old family that has been here forever down outside of Roswell. And so she's got a lot of history with this place. And so that informed a lot of what she, you know, writes in her essay. Then as the book began, the process of creating a book, let me just start there also, is organic in that you start putting all the pieces together, and then you start trying to figure what's missing. What else would the viewer want to know? And the thing that really came strongly back to me was somebody would want to have, you know, some conversation about what my pictures are about. And I had met Janetta last year over at the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum in Oklahoma City, where we had both won awards for our books, mine being Ghost Ranch, hers a book of poetry that she had written. And I asked her if she'd be willing to write about my pictures from a poet's standpoint, you know? Because
yeah.
poets look at things differently than others, and I knew that she would write something really interesting, and I think that she did.
Indeed.
And then Hampton Sides, of course, after the Bain essays were written, we then approached Hampton Sides and asked him, as a somewhat of a newcomer to New Mexico, if he would be willing to kind of, you know, cast the net out there too and write about his experience. And I gave him some photographs, and Marin gave him some writing, and he put together his essay.
Well, it's a wonderful book. It's called Landscape Dreams, A New Mexico Portrait by photographer Craig Varjabedian. And once again, tomorrow, Friday, from 6 to 7, he will be at the CCA Cinematheque which is on Old Pecos Trail, hosted by Garcia Street Books, and it'll be a presentation not only of your work. Are you going to show it big against the screen?
On the screen,
nice,
yeah.
Wonderful. And you'll be there with writer and poet Janetta Calhoun Mish and Doug Peterson.
That's right. He's a community historian here in Santa Fe.
Right. And yeah. So we look forward to seeing you there.
This is such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
It's great to have you, and I hope you come back every time you've got a new book or anything else.
Oh, you're the best.
Thank you. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Nancy Singleton Hachisu. She is the author of the new book, Japanese Farm Food. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's a wonderful, fascinating book that is not only full of recipes, but it is kind of the story of your life, or at least your adult life.
Right.
You were a cook and very interested in food and went to Japan, fell in love with a Japanese farmer, mm-hmm. and spent the rest of your life there.
Well, it's not the rest yet, but I will be there.
So far.
Right. Yeah.
So how did that happen?
Well, you know, after college, I was working in San Francisco in the bar and restaurant business, and I just decided to, enough was enough. And I had, in the early 80s, been introduced to sushi. Actually, it was not introduced. I had eaten sushi and I had eaten Japanese food as a child, but I fell in love in a big way with the whole sushi bar experience. You know, we call sushiya. Bar is not a really good translation of it, but I mean, just sitting down and in front of a counter where we became friends with the master, the chef, and just getting, I mean, that, you know, communication plus the being able just to sit there by yourself or with a friend and get the, you know, those little light bites of food one by, you know, two by two, and just the freshness. It just completely appealed to everything I loved about food and about how I love to eat. And so then I also happened to be into languages, and I really wanted to understand what people were saying. They were always screaming in Japanese. So I was, when I decided to go to graduate school, I thought, well, you know, what the hell? You know, a JD's not enough. I'm going to pop in a master's in East Asian Studies and get some Japanese under my belt, you know. And to that end, I went to Japan as an English teacher to learn Japanese in a year. But it of course, was not going to happen as an English teacher. It's going to take a lot longer, you know. You have to live in the life. So, I met my husband-to-be right away. We were friends for a long time, but I knew I needed to spend more time than one, you know. And so I held off applying to graduate school and just took it as it went along and then never did apply.
And your husband proposed to you and said, would you like to be a Japanese farm wife?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I grew up in Atherton, but my parents were very beatniky. And in fact, my life is a lot more like my original life was now than it was in the intervening years of going off to Stanford, et cetera. But he was very into the, you know, organic style of life. And I was too, to an extent, but not to the extent of like living without electricity. You know, this was his ideal lifestyle and it was not mine. But I knew that he was a good man and I was willing to, you know, just take a chance. But then I did get cold feet and I got my sister to come on over and make sure I was not, you know, making some crazy choice. Of course, she fell in love with him and thought he was the greatest thing and, you know, would always tell me, be nice to him, be nice to him.
And, I mean, it sounds like you have had such an interesting life because there are so many things about cooking and food that were already your interest. Then there
right.
you are working
mm-hmm.
on a farm, which is, as I understand it, even beyond organic, what we
right.
call organic
yeah.
farming.
Because it's called Shizen Noho in Japanese. It's natural farming where you don't use animal products in the field. And we are farmers in that we, my husband's an agrarian, he's a free-range egg farmer, but his family's never grown vegetables and sold them. It's always just been for the family, you know, and that was the traditional model. There's very few of those kind of farmers around, Well, not very, very few, but there's much less than there were, you know, say 50 years ago or 40 years ago.
Because
you know.
Everyone wanted to go to the city and...
Well, also the parents pushed their kids out to the city. And unfortunately what's happened is that their idea was go out to Tokyo and then they thought they would be coming back. But, you know, once they're entrenched in that Tokyo lifestyle, people in Tokyo feel like it's an incredibly convenient place. I find Tokyo to be the most inconvenient place in this, you know, practically in this world.
Why is that?
Well, it's because you're at Shinjuku Station, one of the big stations. It almost takes you an hour to get from to walk from one side to the other. You know, to even find any, you can't move so easily. And we have everything we need within 5, 10, 15 minutes. I don't need 10 million restaurants. You know, I mean, we eat mostly at home, but we've got one great, you know, restaurant that we can, we have several great restaurants we can go to, but they're simple and you don't need a huge choice if you've got some good choices.
Well, and especially it sounds like most of your good choices are at home.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, it feels like if we've got a, you know, growing things, you know, it depends on the weather, energy level. And so, sure, we have more things at one time and less at others, but we are also incredibly fortunate that we have these other Shizen Noho friends who grow professionally, grow vegetables. And there's this one main farmer, and there's more and more farmers who are moving to the area and following in, you know, sort of that they're being mentored by this great farmer who's been doing it for 55 years, a special family friend.
So they're moving out of cities, back to a simpler lifestyle.
Right. And so they're not maybe good at it the first 1, 2, 3 years. The next farmer underneath this main farmer, besides his son, you know, he's been doing it for about 10 years now, and his vegetables have become spectacular. You really can tell they're good, 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 great, you know, and that's exciting. So we have some backup. And so when you have all this gorgeous stuff, you know, and you think it makes, you know, it says cook me, cook me, cook me, you know, and so it's less appealing to go out.
So you grow a lot of your own vegetables. And one of the things I think is so important and interesting is the kind of relationship that you have with the food you're growing. So you write in the book about listening to the vegetables.
Yeah. I mean, I was into organics before I went to Japan, but it didn't mean that I 100% would only buy organic vegetables, you know, and they were hard to find when I was first there. But living with my husband and living with his, you know, with his vegetables and with, it was certainly a process of learning how, I mean, and that, you know, how they tasted differently. And then also that I couldn't just say make up a cooking menu. I was going to do a cooking class a month hence or 2 months hence, and I'm going to use green beans come hell or high water, you know, and there you don't, maybe we don't have them in our area, but they've got them down in Kyushu and they're organic, you know, but by the time they come up here, they're up to where we live, they're, you know, kind of droopy and things. And so, you know, just completely changing the way you look at it, that you go out and the more you pick it yourself and the more you go out there and touch them. And now, I mean, it used to be when we had small kids, my husband would pick the vegetables for me for Thanksgiving or the big events, you know, where there was a lot of vegetables to pick and we had to really, but now I go out ahead of time and I, you know, I just harvest it all and pick it and feel it and think and decide what I want to do with it from how it feels and how it touches. And, you know, I think that all cooks, you know, you can't, not everybody can do that, but you can certainly go to the farmer's market, and the more alive it is, the more, and more exciting it is to cook, you know? So,
what is,
off the soapbox.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. I once, years ago, had a friend who was a really good and enthusiastic gardener. We were eating a salad one day, and right before she started eating, she said, "This salad just wants to be eaten." And it was sort of a beautiful thing because she had, like, a relationship with this.
Yeah.
These
yeah.
kind of very recently living things that
right,
she had grown.
Right, right, right.
And yeah. I wondered, what is it, well, what are some of the basic ingredients of the kind of cooking that you do on the farm? And we're talking about the book, Japanese Farm Food.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, I do all kinds of cooking, but this is one of the kinds of cooking we do. But for Japanese farm food, you're going to need, I mean, you should have great soy sauce. you know, I, and of course I believe in organic soy sauce, and our local soy sauce and miso is available online through Gold Mine Natural Foods. Really good miso, organic miso. Eden Foods is another good alternative for American brands. And good brown rice vinegar. And then after that, I mean, I use Japanese sea salt. That's not, you know, you don't have to use Japanese sea salt, but I used to use Italian, Sicilian salt, Trapani salt, but now I'm in love with the Japanese. I don't think I'll change, you know. We use occasionally some meeting, mirin, you say in English, but a real meeting, a home meeting, not some syrupy, fake sugar stuff.
Right.
Makes a big difference in the flavor profile, you know. And we don't use much sugar in our food because our vegetables are naturally sweet. But after the war, that whole sugar paradigm became more and more popular.
Right.
Especially not just in town food, but all over, you know. But I just wanted to say, jumping back to the vegetables and how they kind of make you want to cook. I think that's one of the reasons why there's a big problem in Japan now. People are cooking less and less. I mean, like all over the world, though I think in America it's sort of resurging, you know, the home cooking. If they don't have great ingredients, you become less inspired to cook. And so, you know, you're on your way home and, you're passing a convenience store and you can just grab one of these, you know, meals that look like they're sort of, it looks like it's all healthy. It's, you know, all balanced and lots of, there's vegetable this and vegetable that and some, you know, meat or fish or put up, you know, but it's got lots of preservatives and MSG and, you know, it's just not a healthy alternative. But, you know, finding those raw ingredients are harder in Tokyo. And so it's a job. But when you find them, when you go out of your way to find them, it makes you excited about cooking. So,
when you say there's a problem in Japan, what is the problem? I mean, is it a health problem specifically?
No. The government, of course, is worried. Yes, it becomes a health problem because there's a rise in obesity in kids. You know, I mean, it's not like the United States, but there's a dip in rice consumption.
Really?
Yeah, rice consumption is declining. It has been declining.
What are they eating instead?
Bread. For breakfast. I don't know about the dinner. And just a decline in home cooking, you know.
Do you find that you feel healthy and that people around you in rural Japan are healthier than people who are eating poorer diets?
It's not just the food. I mean, it's the whole lifestyle, you know, and it's the living with fresh air lifestyle. It's in the cities or in the suburbs, houses are built to be, you know, closed up and used air conditioning in the summer and some sort of a heating, like forced air heating. They don't have central heating, but forced air heating of various rooms. And so the air is not good. And also living in more cramped quarters, there's less dirt, which I find unusual. You know, just the air is different, city air or suburb air. You don't have, you know, dirt from the fields, which is a natural kind of normal thing.
Right.
You know, it's not just one thing, you know. And just, yeah. And I think that, you know, the problems of a modern culture, I mean, like in Japan, we're not just losing food cultures, we're also losing the artisan cultures.
There's a lot of wonderful description in your book about, for example, fixing up the old farmhouse and taking the kind of modern stuff and restoring it to the way it was before.
Right. Yeah, and we were at loggerheads with my parents-in-law about that. I mean, my mother-in-law would say to me, Nancy, you can't use that recycled wood. I'd say, but we like it. It's cool. But no, because, you know, your guests are going to come here and they want to see new wood. So, well, we're living here, you know.
And probably what you, the way you've done it, I mean, judging from the pictures in the book and the way you describe it, is to our contemporary aesthetic much more beautiful, because in fact you're using the old beams and things like that.
Well, the old beams were existing, you know, and this 80, I guess it's been about 85 years since they redid the original structure and they recycled the beams. We didn't do any big structural changes except for make rooms and add walls. We didn't change beams and things like that. But we recycled old wood we had found or places where they had taken up floorboards and, you know. And we stained the white wood that was the new white wood that was put in. It's called hinoki. You know, this a beautiful wood that's desirable for its pretty grain and how it's going to become, you know, burnished over time. But, you know, becoming burnished over time means having a wood-burning fire in your house and waiting 50 years to get this, you know, incredible patina that's, you know, going to happen after we're dead and won't happen because actually we don't have a wood-burning stove anymore, right. You know. And so we tried very hard to stain it in a way that it matched the old wood in the house, and we did.
We're talking to Nancy Singleton Hashisu about the book Japanese Farm Food. Now, give us some examples. Like on an average day, what do you eat for each meal?
Oh, well, I eat toast and coffee for breakfast. Pete's coffee from Berkeley.
So sometimes we just don't adapt.
My husband's going to eat whatever leftovers are hanging around. He likes kimchi, you know. He eats, if he could have rice 3 times a day, he does, you know. Lunch I cook at the school, and so I do any number of things, whether it's Japanese food or Western food. It all depends on my mood, truly, you know.
And you have a school which is an English immersion school for Japanese children.
Yes. And so, I mean, I used to plan the menu ahead of time and sort of follow it, but now I don't even bother doing that because I just, you know, I make what I feel like, and my Japanese assistant is cooking now. But and the kids are incredible. They're from aged, you know, 1.5 to 6. When I walk into school to come, you know, cook the lunch, they come in from playing outside, "What's for lunch today, Nancy?" And I tell them, and even if they don't understand, "Yay!" You know, and they sit for like 45 minutes at the table, all told, which is incredibly unusual for kids that age, and they don't get wiggly. They wait for the food to be finished. I have them sit down before it's actually completely finished, and depending on my timing, I'm finishing it, putting it on the plates, and we're taking it to the table, and then, you know, they're eating and they're having seconds, and we mark who gets seconds, who finishes it, who has the clean plate, who has the cleanest floor area, you know, and they get very excited about, you know, they hold up the plate, look, you know, and they all say, "Thank you for cooking, Nancy," you know, it's incredibly adorable. And it makes you want to cook again for them, you know, and they eat their vegetables, not all of them, but pretty much.
There's a very nice short essay in the book about Japanese strength of character in which you talk about your husband and how he is.
Yep.
Describe that to us. What do you mean?
Well, you know, this is really the farm ideal. There was, and I wonder what's going to happen with, you know, modern Japan. But it's like after the war, all of those farm guys went to Tokyo and made those companies that were so successful. It's this ideal that you get up every morning and you work so damn hard, and you are honest with each other, and you take responsibility for your family. And it's not just you, it's the whole family, it's the whole community that you have responsibility for. There's a deep sense of responsibility, and that this idea of always, you know, working hard and you know, producing. But they have a different rhythm, let me say, that they take tea breaks. They have, it's not just all working hard. So that's where it's a rhythm of life that's different from what I was ever used to. That's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so they wake up really early and they have breaks. They wake up really early and then they come home for lunch, for breakfast around 8-ish. And then they have the meal, you know, and then they, it's not like they're running from X to Z to Y or whatever.
No, they're not frenetic.
No, they don't complain. No. And then they can easily take an hour break. Happily, easily. Now, I get up and I start going and I never stop. I can't take a break. It would make me completely crazy, you know. And it's hard for me to sit down and like just chat with somebody because I always think of all of the stuff I need to do. You know, it's a different way of planning your day, but
and it seems to show up even in these children who are able to sit still, which for American parents they are probably shaking their heads and saying that's just not possible.
Well, yeah, but most Japanese kids are not going to be able to do that either. So it's a thing of the past, you know, in many ways. You know, I mean, as children get older, they learn. You know, they learn in school.
Now, you grew up not eating a whole lot of meat, and
right. That's
part of your lifestyle now, too.
Yeah. I mean, we grew up in a time when my mother wasn't, we had six kids in our family, and she was thrifty, and so pieces of meat were smaller, sunset kind of meals. No big traditional American meals with the roasts and things like that, you know. The closest thing we came was at Thanksgiving and Christmas with turkey.
You celebrate Thanksgiving and Christmas in Japan.
Yep. Well, we have half American kids, so, you know, got to show them something about the life.
Do you miss being here? Do you feel completely happy and at home in Japan?
At Christmas time or any time?
In general.
No, I don't miss it. I mean, I come back enough. And the only odd thing is just, like, part of not being able to like go to the grocery store and run into friends from childhood, things like that. But because of the internet and Facebook and email, but a lot Facebook, you know, you can run into them in a different way.
Right.
And so life has changed. And
you can probably find out more about what they're doing than you did
right,
at the grocery
right.
store.
More than you want.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, day to day, I like my life, and I don't miss the American way of life.
Nancy Singleton Hachisu is author of the wonderful book, Japanese Farm Food, which is available at Collected Works, although I think they're out of it right now, but they're getting new copies
yes.
in. And you, Nancy, will be tonight at 7 o'clock at Bookworks in Albuquerque, and you'll be serving food and signing copies of the book and
yes.
serving homemade miso and... You'll also be teaching, what is it, a food class?
Yeah, where I'll be demoing and teaching a class and lunch at Los Poblanos.
At Los Poblanos, also in Albuquerque. And I don't know if there's any spaces left in that class. I suppose people can call and find
right,
out.
Yeah, I don't know.
We
mm-hmm.
hope to have you back in New Mexico one of these days soon.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.